space engineering is full of unsung roles. This is Western Worlds. Greetings, and welcome to another episode of Western Worlds. I'm John Kissy, speaking to you from the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Space projects tend to be of large size and high complexity. We all know the names and roles of project scientists, astronauts, mission managers, and principal investigators of these missions. They are thrust front and center, but there are many people in the background diligently doing vital jobs that, if not done, would see these missions fall apart. This week we talk to a man whose job is literally to stop that from happening. Oliver Thomas is an engineer working in configuration management at ESA's Technology and Research Center, ESTEC, in the Netherlands. Let's go to the interview. First of all, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to Western Worlds.
It's a pleasure.
So maybe you could start by telling us what your current position is.
Sure. I'm a configuration manager at the European Space Agency. I'm a contractor. I work directly on the Sentinel projects, which form part of a program, Copernicus, in the Directorate of Earth Observation.
Why don't you tell us about your background and whether going into the space arena was always something that you intended on?
Sure. I mean, compared to many people within the space arena, my entry to it would probably be a little unorthodox compared to the majority. I actually began my career in the automotive industry. I worked there for 8 years. I began as a business and administration trainee. I then progressed to become a technical engineering apprentice. I had a couple of roles following that as a system engineer and as a warranty analyst, all very normal jobs, so to speak, in the automotive domain. I learned a lot of things during this period, as you can imagine. The apprenticeships that are offered in the automotive industry tend to be quite different to your conventional apprenticeship. They're very technically focused, a lot of on-the-job training. You work in many different parts of engineering in terms of design and development of cars. So that provided me with a range of skills and experience, if you like. From there, I moved into aerospace in the UK, working on engines for aircraft. And from there, I progressed into the space business at ESA in Holland now. So I'm 34 years old now. I've already got quite a diverse background, if you like, in three different key industries of engineering, if you will.
Was your training very hands-on, on-the-job training? Were there any courses that you did, or how did this lead out from what you did at school?
Sure. I mean, I left school full-time at 16 years old, and my first training program was a two-year program. This was on the more business and financial side of things of the company. I would spend 1 day a week at the college pursuing my academia, if you like. At that time, it was a business and finance course, which would be the same course that you would study if you had gone to college anyway. But we had to cram the course into 1 day, which meant a lot of study in my own time, and weekends, evenings, etc. And I would spend 4 days on placement in various departments in the company. So I would work, for example, I spent 3 months working in the finance department. I spent another 3 months in logistics, another 3 months in IT. So I would move around the organisation and spend a few months in each department, and I would be expected to contribute as one of the team. I was not just there to learn, but I had to very much offer something back. I had to produce, almost had to do a job in every place. And this followed on when I began my technical engineering apprenticeship. This was a 4-year program where I would have day release to go to college. I completed my diploma in manufacturing engineering. And at the same time, I would spend 4 days a week going around different engineering departments in the organisation. And this was really the advantage of the course, because I would be able to see the broad range of jobs that fall underneath the engineering umbrella, if you like, which was very useful at that age. It helped me understand that engineering is probably the most diverse of professions. There's a lot of different things you can do. There really is something for everybody in engineering. And I got to have a go at many different jobs that I would not have had the chance to do that if I would have, let's say, gone to university full-time and not taken this pathway. I actually was given a position towards the end of my apprenticeship as a body and trim system engineer. Now, for those not familiar with body and trim, on a car, you have trim on the inside of the car. You have seats, you have headrests, you have a fascia, a dashboard. On the exterior, you have things like sunroofs and spoilers on the cars. All this needs to be designed and tested and manufactured. And that was my role, to help design and develop new components for new cars, but also help to improve and iron out any of the known concerns with what we were building at that moment in time.
And were you using special software to do this? Were you using like CAD software, or were you like drawing things, making models?
It was a mixture. The joy in many ways of the apprenticeship was we were based at the manufacturing location. So at any time, if there was a problem, I could actually go and pick up parts. I could go and look at cars that were being made, and I could see for myself with my own eyes and hands what the problems were and get a feel for them, which I think is important. Then, of course, we had CAD packages. We were using CATIA programs to look at the engineering drawings virtually, if you like, to understand that the technical side of things, what they should be versus in reality what they are. And of course, I was surrounded by experts who had done this kind of job for 20, 30, 40 years, who could teach me how to investigate and follow up on problems and how to resolve them. So it was really bringing the three things together, touching and feely of the part of looking at problems in real life, looking at problems virtually on the CAD machine, and combining that with people's experience of problem solving. It was a very useful program.
You worked in automotive, then you moved on to aircraft engines.
This is true. When I began working in the automotive industry, it was a big employer in Britain, as it still is in many ways, but there were many British owned car companies at the time. I worked for MG Rover, which was one of them. But sadly, the company went into administration and we were all seeking other professions. Fortunately, a position came up at Rolls-Royce Aerospace within the configuration management department. And they, luckily for me, they took me on. And I was working on the engine development for the Airbus A380 and the Boeing Dreamliner engines within configuration management. I struggled to find something else I was passionate about. I was passionate about building cars, sports cars. I mean, who wouldn't be passionate about building sports cars? So when the opportunity came up at Rolls-Royce to be involved in building the next generation of aeroplane engines, it was something that gripped my attention straight away. And although I'd worked around configuration management in automotive industry, I'd never worked in it, if you see what I mean. And this was my first chance to learn really what it was all about and how it contributed to the overall product development life cycle, if you will. It's actually quite a large part of product development in aerospace, and it's becoming so becoming more so in other industries.
Why don't you tell us about how you moved from Rolls-Royce to ESA?
One day, and I don't exactly know why, I was on the internet, I think, as we all find ourselves, Googling away sometimes, and I typed my job description into Google, and Google presented me with a job advertisement at ESA, and they were looking for someone to come and work as a configuration manager on a project for the International Space Station. Now, initially I thought, wow, that's a leap too far for me. It's something that is way out there. But as I began to read the advertisement, I thought, well, actually, I have many of these skills. Why shouldn't it be me? So I boldly sent in my application. I followed it up with many phone calls, and I got the interview, and 3 months later found myself packing up my worldly belongings into the car and driving over to Holland to start work on the space station program, which was something I hadn't anticipated, but was a wonderful opportunity and one that I really, really enjoyed doing. It was an opportunity I felt I had to take. I had to personally see if I was up to the challenge of working within the space industry, one that I didn't know that much about at the time. And one that I was very curious about. It was a whole industry that in Britain, I think we were at the time a little bit sheltered from what was going on at the European Space Agency. I think that has very much changed recently. I think when you have an opportunity to work in this industry, it would be foolish not to take it. You have to really challenge yourself to see if you're good enough almost to work in this industry, and come and learn what it has to offer. The project I was working on was the Columbus module, which was ESA's biggest contribution at the time to the space station. I came in and it was a year or so away from launching, so I came in at a very exciting part of the project, running up to launch, lots of engineering challenges there to be involved in and around. I got to work with different people from different international organisations. NASA, of course, had overall ownership of the space station, so there was working with the Americans, they were working with all different people from Europe. It was a really fascinating, completely different challenge to what I'd been used to working in the UK.
How did you find the transition to moving over here, going to work at ESA?
Yeah, I mean, it's sometimes things just happen, and it's not until a number of years pass by that you look back and realise what a big transition it was. I mean, from 16 years old till I was about 23 years old, I'd never worked outside of my hometown of Birmingham. When I worked in aerospace, I worked in Derby, which was 2 hours away, which already then was the other end of the world in my mind. Suddenly then to uproot and to move to Holland in an international environment and being the only British person on the team was a complete culture shock at the time. I was working with Italians, Spanish, Germans, French, Portuguese, Scandinavians, Russians. There were people from everywhere on the project, and it made it very, very interesting. It adds a lot of flavour to your daily life, working with people from other countries, other nationalities. They have a different way of working on everything. What time they start in the morning, what time they finish, the coffee they drink, what they have for lunch. Everything is different compared to working in the UK. And it all took getting used to, but it is an experience which I am grateful for. It's made me richer as a person, I think. For sure. And also there's a big lesson there, a wider lesson, in showing that people can come together and produce something fantastic when they want to. all differences were put aside. We had a common goal which we would work towards, and we achieved fantastic things, as products do at ESA on a daily basis. I think it really is almost a model for civilization in many ways, the space industry, for how we should be approaching life in general. We can work together and we can achieve fantastic things when we want. It's quite inspiring from that perspective alone, without even looking at what it is that we are actually doing, which of course is the real inspiration in itself. How we get there is as inspiring as what we do in many ways. I mean, the whole perspective was different. If you think in the car industry, the years I was there, we were building something in the region of 170,000 cars per year. When I was in aerospace, we were in the test development phase, but that was still building tens of engines every 6 months to a year for test. Now in space, we were building one. This immediately changes the whole perspective of what you're doing. We were building one, and we had to build what we were building very well, because once you've launched it into space, there's no going to get it and fix it. This is the noticeable difference. With a car, you can recall the car if things aren't really going that well, and you can take it into the garage and you can do some repairs. There's not much you can do when you've launched something into space. Software-wise, I guess you can change a few things, but if you look at the fundamental hardware, if you haven't got that right in terms of both your design and your manufacturing, if you haven't got that right on ground, you're going to run into serious problems for the mission. So this itself was a different perspective and a different focus for me to get my head around initially, a different focus for what we were doing.
So maybe you could take a little time to give us an in-depth idea of what the configuration manager does.
Sure. Maybe I'll take a moment to discuss a little bit about what configuration management is and how it contributes to product development in terms of anything that you're designing and manufacturing. It's the one profession that on a project, it touches all of the other professions. It links everything together. Imagine if you're building a house. You have an architect, and you have people who lay bricks, and you have an electrician, and you have a plumber. And they all work individually on a project which is building the house. Here, the configuration management person would be the person who sits behind everything and keeps all the records of what is to be done. So they would know at any one time what it actually is that we are building. We would own what the architect has drawn up, his ideas, his specifications, and we would tell the plumber what exactly it is he should be plumbing. We would tell the electrician what it is and where it is they should be doing this on the house. This is the role, conceptually, of the configuration manager. And that's no different in many ways to a space project. Somebody would have an idea for a mission, and this would be defined in requirements. The mission must achieve A, B, and C. These requirements are then owned by the configuration manager, if you like, and we ensure they're documented correctly and put under configuration control. Because these requirements over time will evolve and they become more detailed, and in time requirements become specifications. Specifications are managed by contracts with prime contractors, subcontractors, and so on and so on. You end up with a very detailed specification of whatever it is you're building, which is dynamic. At the start of the project, specifications continue to change, and you have to know at any one time what it is you're actually doing and who is doing what. This is what we call a project baseline, if you like. A baseline of specifications, of interfaces, of requirements, of technical notes, of drawings, CAD models, everything that what captures what the piece of hardware you should be is managed and put under configuration control. So in that aspect, we sit centrally on a project, and we are the library, if you like, for the project. We are the resource of a project who provides the data to the experts for them to make decisions about whether things will or won't work. And we do this from the early phases, so when a mission is being put together, and it lives throughout the whole life cycle of the project. So we manage baselines, we are in charge and responsible of change control. So, for example, a specification might be agreed for a satellite to have, let's say, 2 solar panels. And at some point in time, we decide to have 3 solar panels. How do we process that? How do we deal with that? How do we manage that with the subcontractors? How do we manage that with a schedule, with the launcher? All of this is documented in the project baseline, and we ensure that this is done in an accurate way. We can't afford any mistakes. We can't afford for one subcontractor to think we're going to launch in April and the next to think we're going to launch in May. A satellite is a very complex thing made up of lots of subcomponents, lots of sub-assemblies, lots of subsystems. And in ESA's case, we share this work out throughout Europe. So you have lots of different entities in Europe contributing to one overall system. And the configuration managers, we ensure that that is all done coherently and it all comes together to produce what we said we would produce at the very beginning. This is what we do on the project. We give a dynamic status of what the project should be and what the project actually is.
And now for the roundtable discussion.
What were your thoughts on Oliver Thomas's role and his work?
A pretty interesting role. I mean, you know, not something a non-engineer, I guess, would think about. You know, like, just an idea of someone overseeing to make sure all the teams are working in same units, yeah, and, like, working in the with each other and making sure, like, things are will work well with each other when all the components are brought to the end project table, because most of the missions and spacecrafts and satellites, I guess, there are a lot of different companies and individuals that work on different parts of the project, so there's a lot of need for someone to make sure things are fitting well with each other and working well. So yeah, very interesting position.
I mean, when I first started out in this sort of industry, I never really heard of such a position either, like the configuration manager, but it's actually something that is really, from what Oliver's description, from Ollie's description, is something that's really important. So this is the guy or the gal person who keeps track of every part that goes into the project. So when you're talking about something like a component for the space station, then that's thousands of parts, right?
Yeah.
And they're coming from all over the place because of the various industry connections and the fact that different people are making different things. And then you have, of course, the integration with components from other agencies or countries, mm-hmm. where they may use different standards and so on and so forth. So this is a guy who manages that.
He manages
that so that when one of the instrument teams or one of the staff members on the project decides that they're gonna attach, you know, X component to the
mm-hmm.
to the overall structure, and it's gonna be attached with 2 screws. So now they have to figure out. They have to go to Ollie to make sure that the screws, mm-hmm. the right screws, and that they design the holes the right size for those screws that they're using. And it sounds, on the face of it, it sounds, you know, almost trivial. But when you're involved in something as complex as, you know, all these space missions are going to be,
Yeah.
Then you realize that it's not. Now Oliver comes from the automotive industry, where configuration management's been there for a while. Mm-hmm. And obviously they're producing, you know, hundreds of thousands of units. And so they need to know each part that goes in and where it goes in and when it goes in, so they can make sure each unit is the same.
Yeah.
So, but he went into it, like the difference when you work in space is that you're building one thing.
Yeah.
Right? So,
not like multiple components, exactly. Or so there's multiple pieces of one.
Exactly. So there's absolutely no margin for error at all.
And it's interesting, like, to see just that, you know, how even a small screw it's got to be similar, like, or something. If they're putting it to the International Space Station, it has to make sure, like, it works with other systems that they're installing it with too. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming, because you can imagine, let's say if there is an experimental port to what they're building, it has to work with some of the experiment conducted by using the materials that's already on the space station or something, that has to be compatible.
Exactly. You know, and when it comes to decisions like that, then it's the configuration manager that you need to go to.
Yeah.
So it's not a small job. So
yeah, it's like a project manager, but the project here is building something for a space station.
And of course he doesn't have to memorize everything.
Yeah.
But he has to hold a lot of things in his head.
Yeah.
You know, he has to know a lot of things. He has to know
where things can go wrong.
Exactly,
is like the first thing, like, I think his brain might be thinking when someone is like, oh, would this work? Well, what can go wrong if this at all, you know, whether that would actually go with what's existing. And
this is like an intensive job as well.
Yeah.
And he was so eloquent. He did such an excellent job of explaining it.
Mm-hmm.
Explaining it in terms that were not, you know, that were accessible.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a production of the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration. This episode was produced by John Kissy and Parshu Patel and featured an interview by co-host John Kissy. Our roundtable discussion featured John Kissy and Parshu Patel, and our editors were John Kissy and Dana Beaton, and I am John Kissy. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online, listen to past episodes, and learn more about Western Worlds by going to our website at www.uwo.ca/westernworlds. We are available on Twitter and Facebook, Internet Archive, and SoundCloud. On behalf of everybody at Western Worlds, I would like to thank you for joining us. We hope you will join us again next time, here on Western Worlds.